This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From Antarctica to Europe, it's hot, hot, hot. According to NASA, this past July and August are tied for the hottest months since humans could keep such records on planet Earth. The Arctic sea ice is the second lowest ever recorded. Russian fires are intense, and northern Europeans just enjoyed a second summer in the middle of September. They hit the beaches. What will humans do in a climate-damaged future? In this program, we look at the most awful with science fiction writer Anthony J. Gerst, with the dash of hope after that by carbon herder Ariel Greenwood. In between, you'll hear two new climate rap songs from master entertainer Baba Brinkman. I'm Alex, on with the show. We all want to peer into the future, predicting or guessing what life will be like. When it comes to climate change, science offers some convincing predictions, but we don't know how that climate shift will play out really, and what about in the complex world of debt and financing and invention and war the way we humans are? Our next guest, Anthony J. Gerst, has been following current affairs for decades. Since the 1980s, he's been writing op-eds and letters to editors on many continents. Now Gerst has assembled what he knows into a vision of the new world after a climate catastrophe. The book is The Harp Letters, A Climate-Changing Reality from Crimson Cloak Publishing. Anthony lives where the Iowa River flows into the mighty Mississippi. Anthony Gerst, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, just to clear the air right off, I assume your book is not part of the HAARP conspiracy, the folks who believe that the secret American military facility in Alaska is controlling our weather and maybe our minds. Why did you use this name in your title?
Part of the reason was marketing. I was helping to reach out to that audience as well in selling the book and getting them this information. I had written about climate change for over a decade, and I have decided that I wanted to get the science fiction audience, environmental audience, and if possible, why not reach out to the more conspiracy-minded among us with a little bit of fact.
On this show, we've talked about the new genre of climate-based science fiction. It's called cli-fi. A Taiwan-based journalist named Dan Bloom coined that term, and it was partly an email between us. Is your new book cli-fi, do you think?
It would definitely qualify under cli-fi. It is true science fiction, as well as I have extrapolated upon nanotechnology as an example to create what I call crib sheets. These are a futuristic computer that would be like a small piece of plastic that could actually be rolled up and just stuck in your pocket. They have a 10,000-year life with the battery. They can project multiple three-dimensional hollow screens, plus they are AI. They can learn and store all the information from each user during this time frame. And that's one example of the science fiction aspect of my writing as well.
I think it would be hard to write a book about climate always sliding a bit hotter every year and more violent over several human lifetimes. That may be the way it plays out. We don't really know. Instead, you presume a major event to kick things off that ends one civilization and starts another. What is the event that you use?
I use an event that I have called Big Thunder. This is a plausible event, the probability of which is above my mathematical pay grade to computate. What happens, you're well aware of, and I'm sure you even know Jason Box and his scientific information that's coming out of Greenland, that there are large amounts of increased melt on the surface of the ice sheet that are drawing what I call molens, open air tubes down to the bottom of the ice sheet. This is lubricating it, increasing the speed at which it's moving, and the increased calving. The important part of this that I want to focus on is at some point in the future, there will be enough air pockets in the ice sheet that a sonic vibrational wave will cause major calving to hit. The Mid-Atlantic Ridge in this northern periphery is overdue for an earthquake of over 4.0 and has been overdue for over 100 years. So this is the trigger mechanism that I use that sends out sonic vibration hitting the Greenland ice cap, if you want to call it, an ice cap, and knocks half of it into the ocean to start off with. That, of course, shuts down the Atlantic conveyor belt. The tsunamis sweep out, taking out large sections of the population around the globe. 2 weeks later, due to the reduction of the weight on the island juts upwards, knocking off the rest of the ice. And once again, I'm sure your well-informed audience is well aware of the amount of gigatons of methane and carbohydrates that are in the floor of the ocean around Greenland. This would release into the atmosphere, triggering, you know, instantaneous change.
Well, getting back, say, to your area in America, you talk as though that would develop into badlands. What do you actually picture happening where the majority of people live if we had a mega event?
Well, civilization, global JIT, just-in-time delivery system, would crash rapidly. There would be major pandemics because of the amount of death that was caused along the coastal regions, putting bodies onto the land. They could not be interned properly. The pandemics would sweep the globe for at least, oh, out of 7 years at a minimum, I would say. With the breakdown of the global JIT, I would see the interior cities around the globe basically turn into complete chaos, fighting for the remaining resources that they have available to them, at which point they would start to branch out and go into the countryside, going after people that have stocked up supplies, say, from, well, like gardening. I've gardened, and I have a lot of produce stocked up. People would come out and want to target those type of areas to get their food for survival. It would be, in my opinion, chaos.
Well, actually, that did happen in the 30s in the Ukraine, where people were starving in Moscow, and they just sent big trucks out with soldiers and took every last bit of grain, including the seed grain, from the people in Ukraine who starved to death in the millions. But that's another story. Well, now, some catastrophe books stop at the last survivors living in some cave by themselves. You've gone a lot further. You envision a new economy that could come after this civilization falls. Do you want to talk to us about that, Anthony Gerst?
Well, the new economy, I have it based on Earth First sustainability practices, using industrial hemp and actually growing marijuana as medicine uses. It uses bamboo, it uses flax, and the entire new civilization, bear in mind there are five doomsday shelters. I only deal with the hearth compound in the first book, but there the new civilization is based on a merit-based educational system where people do ongoing education and can change their professions and get into different roles. The key stressor is limiting the size of cities so they're manageable and maintaining a sustainability factor with Mother Earth or being able to fit into the web of life.
All right. Now, you mentioned marijuana. The Canadian federal government, I live in Canada, has promised to legalize marijuana in 2017. That's going to be a major event. I gather you're interested in the role of hemp, but really in the role it can play in the future economy. What can hemp do for us?
Oh, hemp's actually quite a miraculous little plant. If you go into extreme research into it, you can find things from back in the 1930s from the United States government. They're hard to come by, let me tell you. But first of all, hemp makes excellent paper. It uses far less trees. It's a renewable crop. Hemp can take marginal soil, if properly employed, and rejuvenate it quite rapidly, actually. You can make building materials. You can make hempcrete. You can use hemp resin for various compounds. The cellulosic materials found in hemp curds can basically, if you can make it with oil-based cellulosic material, you can make it with hemp. So plastics, etc. Plus, well, like hempcrete, once it hardens, continues to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere for its entire life, which is a obvious benefit at our time. In the soil itself being rejuvenated, the crop brings out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, releases oxygen, another good benefit. I have written papers in the past on just the scientific aspect of this and how it could be used to promote our current economy for at least, I speculate there, 100 years by using this in third world countries where they could actually rotate the crops three times during the year, and simply using it there to make paper products, manufacturing building products, and exporting the raw material of the herds to secondary and primary, you know, first world nations for more technological uses.
Yeah, I think the replacement of cement for concrete is very important because it's a huge source of global warming gases right now. I don't exactly understand how hempcrete works. Do you still have to burn a bunch of natural gas to make it?
I do not believe so. Unfortunately, this has been several years now that I wrote the first section of the book, and I did not have the opportunity to go in and completely review all my hemp information because it's like 2 feet of papers. But no, I don't know about the manufacturing of it. I do know afterwards, though, that it is definitely a plus. And I highly doubt that it would produce the same amount of methane. Is it not methane that comes out of creating concrete?
I'm not sure. I think it's more just the CO2 from the firing up of the furnaces that you need in order to create cement.
Okay.
I think that's where most of the climate change gases come from. And it's like 5% of human emissions or something. It's huge because we use cement all over the place. Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Anthony J. Gerst, author of The Harp Letters, A Climate-Changing Reality. Getting back to your book, Anthony, can you tell us, it takes like the form of letters from the future, is that right?
That is correct, yes.
And so one of the earlier letters from the future, just talk to us about what we might expect in one of those letters.
The earlier letters in the book actually setting up the new world and giving some reflection into what brought them to this state. It is sets up the entire series, actually. One of them that I'm particularly fond of is Seasons of Remembrance. For me, it was good to write because I could reflect back to the 1970s growing up when there were definitely marked changes between spring, summer, fall, and winter, and things seemed to blend together so much more than now, and there's the mixture of when the trees will bloom and everything's getting mixed up as everything changes and the earth continues to rise in temperature.
For sure. All the fruit near us came in 3 weeks earlier this year. We don't know really when winter starts or whether we'll get much of a winter, so it's hard to imagine that those great big cycles that we grew up with and all the animals and plants depend upon are blurring.
Exactly.
Already. And if we had a major event like you're talking about, they'll just shift so far, I don't know what plants and animals would even survive.
Yeah, I would like to point out as well that if a shift like I've been explaining or any abrupt climate-changing event would occur, the scenario that I set up where I install ancient Paleolithic climate that they believe existed, where the Antarctic had their own ocean conveyor belts, and then the Badlands, what I call them, the mid-latitudes, would be poisoned, probably would never come to pass. Because of the methane emissions from the Arctic, it would actually act as the fire under a Bunsen burner in heating our planet.
Well, talk to us about some of the major social changes that you envision might follow a catastrophic collapse of this civilization we live in now.
Okay, I have 5 doomsday shelters. They will each represent a different aspect of humanity's current cultural paradigm. In the Harp Letters, though, what I am striving for is a change in a theological aspect, our educational aspect, and the economy. As I say, it'll be based more on a combination of, well, dare I say, socialism and private barter and trade.
Is the gift economy going to be part of that?
Oh, definitely the gift economy is part of that.
A lot of people don't understand what that is. How do you envision a gift economy working?
A gift economy is where an individual would take their own particular assets to create something, and it would be exchanged to other individuals for their specific talents. A mutual bartering system to help out more or less a, if you want to say, tribal aspect of a community. Do not think of tribal as extremely small or primitive. The city-states would be roughly at maximum 5,000 people, and I've used that off of, I believe it was Socrates who said that was the ideal size for a democratic participation, because this is still a society where everybody is allowed to chip in their opinions on major decisions. Yes, I see a gift economy and a mutual rotation that is done by the educational society of everyone having to spend so many hours a week working in different aspects. These individuals within a city all have an individual plot where they can grow stuff for themselves, and they all have a 10-by-10 plot that they maintain for production of industrial hemp, which would go to the hemp processing center to make all the products for the community.
I love it. The great leap forward, but with hemp. You know, actually, Anthony, on the west coast of Canada, the First Nations people had a system of a gift economy in the sense that they would get together in great gatherings and then give away what they had. There was really no process. You could trade, but there was no process to buy something that came down a long chain of people you don't know, and then it's yours and it's nobody else's. So certainly we have lived other ways in the past, and under a huge climate stress, these things could come back.
Well, that would be ideal. I would like to see something like this happen before one of these events actually transpire. My problem with that, and I'm sure yours as well, is we can look at humanity and see the tribal us versus them concept, or paleo us versus them concept, if you want, in regards to so many aspects of our current paradigm, be it nation states, ideologies, theologies. Unless we learn to come together as a people, we have no hope, in my opinion, of mitigating the circumstances that are in the pipeline and heading towards us at this time.
Well, given where we are, do you think we have to break the system to make a new one?
I think the system has to collapse in order to make a new one, yes. Simply because I do not see the willpower, well, one, in the people to unite as one, but that would happen long before the status quo that controls the fiscal and governmental aspects of the globe would surrender their power. I stress a lot in here, and especially in the series, that the greatest danger to mankind is our greed and our power lust. And will we be able to overcome these? Two of the doomsday shelters, the heart compound being one, works towards integrating within the web of life. The other two will represent more materialistic and current consumeristic exploitation of the natural world around them, while the fifth, which is deep underground at the CERN Collider, takes on another sci-fi aspect in that living that deep down, they live in dark conditions because they're devoting all the energy towards their high-tech projects. These were the smartest people on the planet when everything went to crap. And by the time the 10,000-year series is done, 10 books jumping ahead every 1,000 years, these people become what we think of now as greys.
As what?
The gray aliens.
Oh, okay, because a lot of people are not familiar with gray aliens.
Yeah, this throws in the science fiction aspect to the book as well. I think it's important for me anyway as a writer to have science fiction aspect in this work because it extrapolates from current knowledge and projects what could happen. Their eyes grow bigger over generations because of deep underground living in a darkened environment, so it grows bigger to allow more light in. Their skin becomes more translucent and eventually turns more of a gray because they're not exposed to direct sunlight. So this gives off then the appearance, they're not going to have the extremely bulbous heads of what a gray alien would or three fingers, but they would take on some attributes to where they would look alien to the people on the surface.
Well, you know, it's strange because I know that the first mammals had to go underground. They were very small. They were like mice. They were our ancestors. During a previous climate disaster that happened about 55 million years ago, it was just too hot to live above the surface. So all of that's still possible, and there are great caves. Even in the United States, there's some huge thing, I don't know if it's in Missouri, but it's in the central United States, where the American government built a giant city underground. It's got a post office and a police station and warehouses for companies to drive trucks around under there in these great caverns. So all of that, you know, it's ticking away as a possibility.
Plausibility is how I look at them because, once again, the probability of survival there in a climate-changing situation would have to do with the atmospheric change. One of the doomsday shelters I have in the, I believe it's pronounced Vihenek Range in Russia, but it's right on the border of where the Badlands and the Arctic would be.
Mm-hmm.
So So what I do here is take the poisoned atmosphere over generations that they are at times breathing as it shifts northward in the atmospheric circulation pattern. And it basically not retards, but regresses their human development. I've seen reports that autism can be caused from environmental factors, one of which is mercury coming from foods and stuff, compiled with several other environmental factors. So this is how I'm extrapolating doing that and projecting that into the future as well.
Well, again, that might sound outlandish, but we've had a very important scientist, Peter Ward, on this show saying that in a previous climate mass extinction, that he thinks that what happened was that the atmosphere did become poisoned because of a change of creatures in the sea that were emitting sulfur dioxide, which is poisonous to us, and that that would have washed over the mainland and killed off the creatures that breathed it, except for, he thinks, the dinosaurs developed some ability to survive it because of differences in their lungs. So what you're talking about sounds outrageous for the future, and certainly it's not going to happen in the near future, but it has happened in the past, so maybe.
Yeah, I found that interesting. I was unaware of that aspect of it. I use algae blooms, cyanobacteria blooms, mm-hmm. as the transmission device that carries the atmosphere over and across near the shorelines. And now the other ones are just the standard atmospheric transmissions. But yeah, that's intriguing information. Thank you.
So how can people get a taste of your writing, Anthony?
You throw in Anthony J. Perry Gerst in a search engine with quote marks. You ought to be able to get a little bit of everything from, my letters to the editor. Boomer Warrior is based in Canada. That's an environmental site. I wrote for them in the very beginning before my book was accepted by Crimson Cloak Publishing and I took directions. But I have like 5 articles of Boomer Warrior. Op-Ed News is another source. It was an online featured blogger for Planet Save before they changed. I'm sure they were sold out to a major corporation that didn't quite like my controversial style of writing.
I'm just going to say, from the heartland of America, we've been talking with author and observer Anthony J. Gerst, and you can find his vision of a possible future after climate disruption in the book, The Harp Letters, A Climate-Changing Reality. It's on Amazon, of course, and on Kindle, too. You can follow Anthony on Twitter with the hashtag @climatewriter. That's a pretty basic tag, and I think it shows how early Anthony got into all this. Thank you so much for talking with us, Anthony J. Gerst.
I thank you today, Alex, and thank you for the opportunity to reach your audience.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. In just a couple of minutes, we'll talk with a bright young voice living out one of the best hopes to avert the worst of climate change. But first, we turn to the Canadian rapper and playwright Baba Brinkman. Believe it or not, he set the ponderously named Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, into modern rap. Give it a listen.
Definition of hardcore. Check out the Intergovernmental Climate Report. It says the world is getting warmer unequivocally, and the oceans have increased 30% in acidity, and 90% of the warming trend is oceanic and concentrated in the Arctic. Nobody panic, but the level of greenhouse gases in the air is higher now than it's been in millions of years. We added more than a trillion tons of CO2 to the atmosphere. It's gonna be centuries before some of the gas is clear. I'm dropping science unvarnished, unbiased, but I don't blame you if your instinct is to deny it, cause we evolved to prioritize immediate threats. If it bleeds, it leads, that's what the media says. So let the gangster-esque rap music paint a picture, and I'll hit you with some evidence-based predictions. Get ready for wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Hollywood
Hollywood summer blockbusters can't touch this. I get my thrills from the latest reports published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, formed in 1988 to get the science straight. Now they dropped the fifth assessment and the data's up to date, so allow me to summarize. Bad things on the way, higher emissions, sea level rise, dire predictions on target for disaster movie style predicaments. In Copenhagen we set a limit of 2 degrees, but that's still enough to disintegrate major ice sheets over the course of centuries, or maybe decades. Yeah, some of the details are still up for debate. They fluctuate between certain disaster and likely disaster, slow and steady or higher and faster. Consensus, it's the lowest common denominator, which means it's probably gonna be way worse than the wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. So be afraid. Be very afraid, but we're not, despite what the scenarios say. And the effect of talking about it is visible yawning and occasionally changing our behavior microscopically. And even those who get it tend to get it logically, but not viscerally. So we're navigating myopically. The threat is existential, it's not environmental, and your individual response is inconsequential. Only coordination of our whole species is gonna keep coastal cities from sinking below the deep seas. And when was the last time a solution included all of us? Geophysics is at the mercy of geopolitics. Climate change communicators, keep it positive. People need to feel like they still have options, and we do have options. Either we find a solution or we stick with the business as usual level pollution and get used to the wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC. Wars, famines, droughts, floods, hurricanes, heat waves, murders, thugs, chaos, refugees, stress, disease, extinction, disaster, IPCC.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. I'll put a link to my 2014 interview with Baba Brinkman in my show blog at ecoshock.info, and we'll hear one more Brinkman piece at the end of this program. But right now, let's look at how we could put massive amounts of carbon back into the soil using nature instead of abusing her. There's a lot of different job descriptions. One that often draws a blank for our next guest is herdis. Ariel Greenwood isn't just talking about holistic agriculture or putting carbon back into the soil. She's living it and right through the long-lasting California drought. From Santa Rosa, California, Ariel Greenwood, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's really nice to be here with you.
So, Ariel, what do you tell people you do for a living?
Oh, it depends on who I'm talking to. Generally I say that I work with animals in a restoration context. Sometimes I say I manage cattle and so on, but, you know, more so than herdist lately, I've been identifying as a grazer, which is not a common term here in the U.S. I think it's pretty ubiquitous amongst our Australian friends, but I usually choose that word instead of, you know, maybe rancher. Just because I think words like rancher have all kinds of different connotations for different people, a lot of which are maybe inaccurate or unfair. And so because the work that I do is really about the process of working with animals in a restorative context, more so than any particular final product, I like to use grazer to sort of emphasize that part.
All right. Now, would you tell us a bit about Pepperwood Preserve?
Sure. So Pepperwood Preserve is a 3,200-acre private operating foundation in the Mayakama Mountains of Sonoma County, California. We're about an hour and a half north of San Francisco. So I work on site there. I'm not actually employed by Pepperwood. I'm employed by a small company called Holistic Ag. But the cool thing about Pepperwood is that while it is a, you know, conservation-focused land base, it is a preserve through and through. Everybody there is pretty progressive in their conservation ethics and fairly adventuresome. So
a case in point for that is just the fact that they are working with us to use management-intensive and planning-intensive grazing to improve grassland. And, you know, it's unique in California because so much of California grassland has been highly degraded, whether through mismanagement or lack of management, overgrazing, undergrazing, et cetera, for really a couple of centuries, I think you could argue. So to use cattle, which have been a pretty destructive force in the landscape, as a restorative force, it's in some ways a novel thing out here, but our results so far are supporting our work.
How many cattle are you looking after?
Around 150, I believe 152 at my last count, and it's a growing herd. We're not yet to carrying capacity of our land base. The best way to think about that, though, is in terms of animal units, which is essentially 1,000 pounds of animals. So since we are a cow-calf through finish operation, which means we are breeding and finishing animals here in the same herd and the same land base, we have animals of varying ages. So we're at about 105 animal units, so that's 105,000 pounds of animals that I'm working with on a daily basis to move them across the landscape.
Wow. Well, you know, I did interview the producer of Cowspiracy, Kip Anderson, and that interview remains quite popular. People are downloading it. And so some of the people who care about nature think it's a crime to eat beef. And I know you run into that. What do you say?
I do. Yeah, it's a complicated conversation, but it is one that's worth having. And I should say the first thing on that note is that I really appreciate having conversations with people who are thinking and caring about that, because I think really the reason industrially raised livestock, in particular beef, has become such an egregious force on our global ecosystem is because too few people cared. Too few people were actually watching the inputs and outputs and the requisite land use that supported that system. So now that people are starting to care, we're kind of doing, you know, a 180, and the pendulum is swinging arguably too far the other way. But I'd rather kind of work with and be in conversation with people who are sensitive to the welfare of animals and operators and land. So really what I say, though, is I try to invite people into a conversation about grasslands, because I find that most people think about it purely from an agricultural perspective and often purely from an ethical perspective, in the sense of a particular ethical persuasion they have, and then they're working deductively from there. My starting point in how I interact with the landscape is I want to be a beneficial, restorative force anywhere I am. So because my context, my landscape of choice, is California, native California grassland, because that landscape has been neglected for so long, it makes sense to be using domestic livestock in this context. And, you know, one of the encouraging things that I'm finding is that when you appeal to ecology, and in particular an ecology that people really resonate with, you know, most people maybe haven't had a lot of meaningful experiences with native grassland, but just the image of sort of sweeping open fields with some, you know, tree-dotted savanna, I think resonates with a very deep and old part of us. So when you can literally and figuratively ground the conversation, people let their guard down and they start to expand their thinking away from this binary view of, is it right or wrong to kill animals or is it right or wrong to eat meat, into a more holistic question of what is my bioregion and then what kind of stewardship does my bioregion require? And then how do I, as an eater, who is going to have an impact on that bioregion for good or for bad, how do I make decisions that are in keeping with that understanding? So that's kind of where I'm trying to steer the conversation these days and really leave people with more questions than answers, because I think once we have questions about things, we have the sort of humble posture required to explore.
Well, now, it caught my attention, I think it was on your Facebook page, could have been on your website, where you were slated to give a talk called Regenerative Agriculture, Buzzword or Last Hope for Reversing Climate Change. What do you tell people about the role of farming in the climate fight?
Sure. Yeah, that talk was actually just yesterday in San Francisco at the Social Capital Conference. It was a panel with some other really, really great people. You know, it's a big conversation, but I would say that agriculture is really the greatest force that we have. It's the way we exert ourselves and kind of throw our anthropogenic weight around the planet, you know. And because of that, because we have an agricultural system that is extremely dependent upon fossil fuels and especially on mismanagement of soil, our climatic situation can be pretty much directly attributed to the choices we've made as agrarian humans for the past 10 or 12,000 years. But when you look at the specific components of that, especially soil management, you find that, okay, if a big part of the problem is that we've been abusing our soil, we've been destroying our soil, overgrazing our soil, undergrazing our grasslands, but especially tilling our soil to produce annual commodity crops to feed humans or livestock or produce biofuels, the obvious answer is that we just need to find a way to produce the goods that we want to consume in a way that builds rather than destroys soil, or we need to adjust the goods that we consume to something that is inherently non-destructive, such as switching our diets more towards a perennial food system. And I refer a lot of people to the book Carbon Farming by Eric Tonesmeyer. His livestock section definitely needs an update. There's been some interesting research coming out with scientific research verifying the beneficial role of planned grazing in a lot of contexts. But overall, his exploration of the role of tillage and how we can change the way we produce food and change the kinds of food that we produce, it's our biggest and best leverage point. And, you know, Gregory Landway was the host of the panel that I was on yesterday, and he's a really great mind in the regenerative agriculture scene. And some of your listeners may know him from something he produced along with Ethan Rowland called The Eight Forms of Capital. So this notion of multi-capital enterprises as opposed to strictly measuring things in terms of their, you know, monetary value. He was making a point that we actually have the single most profound tool to reverse climate change, and we've had it all along, and that's very simply photosynthesis. You know, the very act of photosynthesis takes CO2 from the atmosphere and produces biomass. And the problem now is that we're not then returning that biomass into the strata of our soil where it can be stored essentially in perpetuity, provided that soil remains intact. So it's curious when I hear, you know, friends of mine, especially in the Bay Area, who are getting excited about geoengineering or getting excited about synthesized protein and so on, spending a whole lot of money and a lot of their lives in these supposedly new technologies that we need, when in fact we have the best technology, it's photosynthesis, but the problem is just that we don't have the people systems there to wield photosynthesis in a really responsible way. We're still very extractive.
I totally agree with you there, you know, because getting carbon back into the soil, in my opinion, it really is our last best hope. That's where carbon belongs. There's way more carbon in the soil than in the atmosphere, and there used to be a lot more before we started doing the type of farming that we're doing. I guess one of the barriers is how we transmit the tech of holistic agriculture to millions of farmers speaking hundreds of languages all over the world. Can we do it? Can we do it in time? What do you think?
That's a great question. So the company I grazed with, Holistic Ag, which was founded by Aaron Lucich a few years back, we found that there seems to be kind of a mycelial network of things, which is will be no surprise to you and a lot of your listeners, but there's an exponential growth in excitement over grazing, land stewardship, soil, et cetera, which, by which I mean that the work that we're doing is serving as proof of concept for this stuff, and so the amount of land that, you know, we could potentially access this year is significantly more than the year prior and the year prior and so on. So that kind of upward exponential growth and interest and opportunity is extremely exciting to me. And I think it actually can outpace the problem. You know, the group that's doing the most to spread holistic management, which is a decision-making platform, and the way that we practice that is especially in planned grazing, but holistic management lends itself to so many things. The group responsible for propagating that the most globally is the Savory Institute, which was started by Alan Savory, who is the progenitor and mastermind behind holistic management. And, you know, folks from the Savory Institute, I was just talking to Chris Kirsten, who is Alan's right-hand man, the other day. He said they were testifying before Congress, which they'd never done before. So the audience is growing. They are working with practitioners, you know, ranchers, land managers across the globe, and their hub network is helping to serve as these nodes that are then educating and supporting practitioners in the given bioregion. So that being said, I think we need to very rapidly move beyond the model of landowner-operator. And, of course, a lot of ranchers have maybe not own land, but they've had these long-term leases for a long time. But even that system, I would say, privileges those who have long-standing relationships in a given area or a lot of capital. We know that we need to be grazing a lot more land with a lot more animals in a management-intensive way, and so that's going to require a lot more people. So to me, the biggest bottleneck and barrier, it's not technology, it's not even money, it's just simply getting the people who are desperate to access land and who are capable of being sensitive stewards long-term, matched with land, matched with animals, so they can just get to work. This problem we have now of a lot of people excited about doing this, willing to dedicate the time to learn the skills, willing to learn stockmanship, and willing to learn ecology, not being able to access the very tools through which they could be helping us reverse climate change so everybody can continue to live on this planet. Now, that's an absurd problem to have. It's just ridiculous and unnecessary. So that's, I think, what we need to start directing our attention to.
Well, I have interviewed Alan Savory, and I'll put a link to that interview in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. And you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and my guest is Ariel Greenwood. We're talking about agriculture, which can help restore the planet instead of damaging it. Ariel, there you are in the long-standing California drought. Are you pumping up groundwater to keep your cows alive?
Yeah, we are. And luckily, the land base we are on has a decent aquifer below it. And I'm fortunately, you know, to be partnered up with this guy who started this company, who is a water and infrastructure mastermind. So while I do all the day-to-day and a lot of the long-term planning, Aaron has been able to figure out how we can move water through gravity feeding, through, you know, portable poly pipes and solar panels across all of a 4,000-acre land base, including through, you know, two 500-foot deep canyons. So what that means is I can take the herd out and graze them at density and incredibly sensitively on foot as one operator and 150 animals in places where most people just turn their cattle out and let them either fend for themselves or poke around, overgraze and undergraze. So it's been challenging. You know, the drought affects our forage for sure. But the beautiful thing about this kind of grazing is the better you do it and the longer you do it, the more you are increasing soil health and the more you're increasing your effective rainfall. So, you know, the trend for a lot of holistically managed land bases globally is that they are increasing their stocking rates while all of their neighbors are culling or selling cattle because they just have more and more and more forage, more biomass to keep up with. And by virtue of, quote, keeping up with it, you are cycling that back into the soil. So it's an upward trend in a time when, you know, we're suffering from negative downward spirals globally. So it's a really beautiful process to be a part of.
A lucky time to be alive. You know, to be honest, Ariel Greenwood, your photos look more like a hip young city woman. How did you get involved as a cowgirl, if I could call you that?
Sure. Well, I've got you fooled. I grew up back in North Carolina, where I'm from, in the Southeast U.S. And I didn't even go to school until college, until university. And so most of my time was spent in the ratty rural wilds of unsupervised land base. And I had horses and chickens and dogs and fishing poles and bikes and spent a lot of time just on my own pursuing my interests. And when I got a driver's license, I found a job at a farm that was a, you know, diversified, sustainable vegetable and perennial herb farm. So from there, I just incrementally was exposed to kind of the plight of our planet and the role of agriculture in that. And then in college, I studied psychology along with agroecology, which is a really helpful pairing. And so I could learn about the people systems, but also the ecological systems behind sort of our agricultural scene these days. And was exposed during that time to holistic management, to Alan Savory, to the role of managed ruminants and grassland ecosystems. And so while I was working part or full-time all through college, producing vegetables and fruit in different contexts, I was really getting very excited about the prospect of working with animals on a large land base. So eventually found my way to California and worked really hard to be paired up with a herd, which I now have been working with this herd of cattle on Pepperwood with Holistic Ag for almost 2 years. So it's been a winding path, but the longer I'm in it, the more I feel like it's the place to be, and I'm really excited about trying to play my part in bringing more and more people, young and old, to, you know, better relationships with land and animals, because we just so critically need more, you know, boots on the ground and hooves on the ground, as it were.
And speaking about that, in a past show, I talked with activists in the young farmer movement. I interviewed dirt farmer Severin von Scharner Fleming of Greenhorn Radio. Do you think there is a path for young people to get into producing honest food?
You know, it's hard to say if it's getting better or worse. People like Severin, or my friend Evan Wigg out here with the Farmers Guild, and many others have made it much more possible for people like me than would be the case were they not, you know, fighting tooth and nail for us to have access to land and capital. The trend that I see that I'd like to call attention to, though, is that, you know, the sort of pastoral or agrarian ideal is common and healthy. And so what happens is a lot of, especially in the Bay Area, but increasingly across the country, people make money in an industry that maybe is within their expertise or aptitude, but doesn't necessarily lend itself to the management of complex biological or social systems. So these people end up buying land, build a second house, or move into a spot and have notions of wanting to farm, don't really know what that means. Maybe they get in contact with an ambitious young farmer who doesn't know how to look out for themselves in these relationships, and they strike a deal. Everything goes great until the honeymoon period wanes, and people end up at each other's throats, even though they started with a beautiful vision of cooperative land management. So what I would say is we have the people who are desperate to access land and produce food ecologically for their communities and, you know, leave the planet better for it, but a lot of work needs to be done on the part of landowners to mature their understanding of how to work, how to enable people to be stewards on their land, how to make cooperative lease arrangements that are reasonable, how to invest in infrastructure and capital that is meaningful. And I would encourage any landowners who maybe identify with that to look at groups like the Farmers Guild, to look at groups like Greenhorns, and especially Agrarian Trust, which is a side project of Severin at Greenhorns. It's really working hard to help, again, mature the relationship between landowners and, you know, tenants or potential agricultural operators.
What's happening with the Eat Local movement in your area?
I mean, it's incredibly robust. And when I moved to Sonoma County here in Northern California, I didn't understand much about the place. I was relatively new to California. I was just looking to access animals and grassland. Now that I'm here, I feel extremely blessed to be in a place where people value the story behind food. And it's interesting, especially in the grass-fed scene, because, you know, everyone's off to the races to be able to produce grass-fed and especially grass-finished beef. But that's going to look very, you know, grass-fed beef finished on coastal pastures is different from grass-fed beef finished on inland Myakama, Mediterranean, you know, more arid pastures like what I'm on. And so what I found is that with my fortunate market being the whole Bay Area, my beef isn't for everybody, but the story that I tell, that it's funding this kind of ecological work, that the flavor is incredible and everything that went into that animal comes from one land base, is really well received by enough people. What I will say, though, is that there tends to sometimes be this phenomenon of a false sense of sufficiency, and that people think, well, I go to Whole Foods and I buy a few things from a farmer I know, and that's good enough, and it gives me a pass to buy everything else, you know, according to what is convenient. You know, we don't organize our lives around food anymore, and I didn't used to either. I totally understand it. If you want to develop an appetite for not just the food stuff itself, but for the culture and the experience of food, it takes time. It takes, you know, omitting certain things from your lives so that you can have the time to fellowship with people around food, to play with food, experiment with food. But what I would encourage people to think about is that insofar as we have sort of a biological, evolutionary hardwiring for enjoyment, food is, it fits perfectly. It's a very efficient way to have fun and experience pleasure. And, you know, more importantly, perhaps a very efficient way to have a beneficial relationship with the planet at a time, you know, when we are in another mass extinction. So we all have a part to play, you know, and there's this quote that that is oft repeated to my circles, and it's a Wendell Berry quote that I like very much, and it's, eating is an agricultural act. But what I try to remind people is that eating is also an ecological act, because all of agriculture comes from soil, it comes from land, and that means ecology. So the more we equip ourselves to be naturalists, to be interested in our bioregion or the bioregion of where we're buying our food, the more we're able to have a meaningful and beneficial relationship with, not just with farmland, but with nature as a whole. And that's sovereignty right there. You know, I can't imagine anything being really more deep down exciting than that. It's a very enlivening idea to a growing number of people.
I love what you just said. Why don't we wrap this up? Maybe you could just tell us a story of what your work can really be like out in the hills of California with the cows.
Sure. You know, it varies from day to day, month to month, and time of year. You know, some of the time I move the animals 1 to 3 times a day. Other times we practice something called backgrounding, which is sort of modified open turnout when the perennials aren't growing so they can't be overgrazed, and when the animals could experience the most heat or metabolic stress. So we just kind of let them poke around on dormant grassland for a couple months and keep them out of areas they shouldn't be grazing. That's what I'm doing right now. But then next week I will be herding everybody together, bunching them up and taking them out into some pretty gnarly, steep grassland. It's a region called the Bald Hills and aptly named. And, you know, what I would remind people is that this is incredibly hard work. Very rewarding and all that, but very hard. It's work that relies on, you know, management of resources across time. You have to hit your marks hour by hour for the whole system to sing in the way that it needs to. It can be physically incredibly taxing. You know, there's some of the areas I graze can't be accessed by really anyone besides four-legged cloven hoofed animal, and that does not include horses, or, you know, a two-legged mammal such as myself. There's just not much else besides, you know, smaller creatures and predators that can go out there. So I can't take an ATV there. I can't take a horse there. It's just me moving animals. You know, I do a lot of planning and mapping with Google Earth, which is a great, easy, free program for people to use for land management. And then I upload those files to Celeste Dodge, who is the systems ecologist here, and she takes all of our grazing data from the past 4 years, so including before I arrived on site, and creates a GIS spatial database that we can query and show our impact and our decision-making across time, and which is a really helpful tool because this really is a long game. Increasingly, I'm excited about the notion of community-supported grazing, and I'm just using that as sort of a catch-all term for grazing systems where some of the intense labor that just simply putting in time moving animals, whether herding or building fence, comes not just from single operators, but from the community, from people who are going to be the ones eating the beef, the product of that grassland. That's something that I don't know I'll be able to explore anytime super soon, but long term, again, I think we need everybody having some relationship with grassland if they're in a bioregion that has grassland, and more of a relationship with animals. So I would love to share some of the burdensome aspects of my work with people who would enjoy that kind of physical and psychological stimulation. So that's kind of something I'm thinking about. But overall, it's a lot of exertion. It takes a lot of grit and focus, but it's very beautiful and very satisfying work. But it's certainly not for everybody.
From Pepperwood Preserve in Santa Rosa, California, we've been talking with the new modern herdist, Ariel Greenwood. I'll put links to Ariel's Facebook page and land blog in my own show blog at ecoshock.info, but you can go straight to her website at arielgreenwood.com. Her first name is spelled A-R-I-E-L. And Ariel, it has been a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Same here, Alex. I enjoyed the conversation.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week. We'll close out with another climate performance piece from Bava Brinkman's new album, The Rapt Guide to Climate Chaos. Bava Brinkman has performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, on the Rachel Maddow Show, and at the Sydney Opera House, including a rap version of Shakespeare's Canterbury Tales. In 2014, he brought out the album Rapt Guide to the Wilderness. Now he's back with a new one, The Rapt Guide to Climate Chaos. couldn't be better timed. You can get 4 cuts off the new coming album at Bandcamp.com. You can get them cheap. I'll put a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. In this complex piece I'm going to play you called Carbon Bubble, Brinkman does what we all do. He agonizes over his own role, burning fossil fuels just to earn a living. But the piece is deeper than that. It calls out a caricature of what I would call the super carbon human.
For producing some emissions and pollution, but this rhythm in the music is my living. When I do it, I get paid. Yeah, it's been a decade since I've had a day job, and I did it my way, like Frank Sinatra. I'm just kicking up a racket. I could be at a university teaching classes, but this is more fun than teaching. Look at the people I'm reaching. Been around the world. I fly to Europe for the weekend, do a gig in California before I fly to New Zealand. Encyclopedic Rolling Stone, pinch me, I'm dreaming. And you can check my status. Got a U.S. visa, 01, artist of extraordinary achievement. This is all I've ever wanted, baby, living the life. In the past 5 years, 150 flights, 15 countries, 40 states and provinces. And as for carbon emissions, I'm off the charts with it. Fossil fuel is how I got here, both to entertain you and in my career. If you're earning something, well then you're burning something. Prosperity is driven by internal combustion. Something holler back. We got Mother Nature on her back, but it's a one-time thing, never call her back. Hydrocarbons at both ends, burning to make money and burning to spend. And no one tells me how to dispose of my own property. A globe-trotting solo artist with total autonomy. This is what I am, fossil fuel is a part of me. It powers 80% of the global economy. In other words, if you have some money, it's got oil stains on it, your hands are bloody. And if you don't believe me, go ahead and do a study. Pimping ain't easy, you better ask somebody. Cooking with gas is pimping, driving a car is pimping, energy consumption is pimping. Look at how we're living gangster compared the horse and buggy days, cranking up the air conditioner on muggy days. You're not freezing to death in the winter. If energy consumption is a sin, I'm a sinner. Life is good, it's better than it used to be. Let the good times roll, fossil fuels are cheap. That's how we stay hella major. Prosperity is the bomb, player hater. Something holler back. We got Mother Nature on her back, but it's a one-time thing, never call her back. The lights conserve power, everything goes dark, it's earth hour. We're taking action on climate change, all together now, back to the stone age. In the meantime, I'll be up in Vegas, illuminated, laughing at you player haters. Face it, ballin' is part of our nature, embrace it. You love energy wasting, would you rather be living large and comfortably, or in a shack burning dung for heat? Some people don't have a choice, but you do, so don't hit me with any hypocritical voodoo about trying to reduce my footprint voluntarily. I'm trying to make ends, I can't let them barely meet. I'm always trying to get more gigs and fly more. I got a wife and a daughter to provide for, and maybe one day solar will supply us. I hope so, it's better for global climate. Just don't make me choose between solar and diapers, and don't make me switch off my amplifiers.
Radio EcoShock. Bright voices in dark times. Get more. EcoShock.info.